This morning we're going to be in John chapter 10, verses 1 through 42. So if you'd like to open your Bibles so that you can follow along, I would recommend it strongly. You're going to be doing most of the reading today because I can't see my notes. But let's, as we open up to John chapter 10, we can see that chapter 10 is the last chapter in a long section of material, which began back at chapter 7. There was this dialogue between Jesus and his apostles, dialogue between Jesus and the Pharisees, dialogue between Jesus and the Jews, between his believers, his unbelievers, and we're kind of coming to an end. And as we've noticed earlier on in the lesson, that as these dialogues went on with Jesus and as his conversations with people changed from individuals who would know very little to individuals who claim to know a lot, that his demeanor, his way of speaking to them changes a little bit, doesn't it? Those who have this knowledge, these Pharisees and these Jewish leaders, should have known better. And so as he has conversations with them, and we'll notice as we get through this lesson here, that he gets a little bit harsh with them. And we're kind of getting soft in our world, where we don't want to be have people speak to us harshly. We have a hard time speaking to other people harshly. But sometimes it's time to just make the point, isn't it? And Jesus has spent enough time with these individuals that he is simply going to get to the point. So far, we have noticed Jesus is challenged by his brothers. So they came to him and they said, "Why aren't you doing more? Why aren't you promoting yourself more?" Jesus dismisses their worldly approach and goes on to the feast without fanfare and teaches the people. There's a great division among the people over his claims and his teachings. The Pharisees tried to trap him by using a woman caught in adultery. After this fails, there is again a division among the hearers, with some believing and others unwilling to accept his claims. The ones who say they believe in him quickly turn when he calls on them to obey his words in order to be freed from their sins. Jesus then heals a man born blind. This causes his main enemies, the Jewish leaders, to accuse Jesus of sinning because the miracle was done on the Sabbath day. And I know we didn't spend a lot of time on what can be done and what can't be done on the Sabbath day. There's a lot of material that has to get covered through these things, so we can't always hit on those things, but I do think that that's one of those conversations that we should probably have a little bit later. In the end, the leaders cannot deny or refute the great miracles done by Jesus. They cannot even persuade the healed man to witness against Jesus, so they throw him out. As Ted discussed last week, that throwing him out is a throwing him out of the synagogue, most likely. Once released from the Jews, we see Jesus revealing himself to the blind man, who acknowledges his faith by worshiping the Lord. In the last scene, Jesus denounces the Jews for their spiritual blindness in not accepting him. So all that is from chapter 7 on up to this morning. And this brings us to chapter 10, where Jesus will have one more volley, if you will, of debates with the Pharisees before leaving Jerusalem and beginning the series of events that will lead to his death and his resurrection. So we're coming to the end. We're going to start this morning in 10, verse 1, with the parable of the Good Shepherd. So chapter 10 is a continuation of chapter 9. The original manuscripts, and we've talked about this before, but it bears reading. So the original manuscripts didn't have verses and numbers, chapters. So there were continuations of conversations. These are man-made divisions in the Bible. And so sometimes we can get a little bit confused when a chapter ends, and yet the conversation continues into the next chapter. That's how we get into contextual errors. We try to do this separation when really we need to look at the context of the whole chapter. Larry used to stress that a lot. Read the whole thing. Dean stresses that a lot. When we're studying out of a chapter, it's a good idea to read the entire chapter. so that we have an understanding of what it is that's being talked about. The parable of the Good Shepherd follows on the heels of this condemnation. So Jesus condemns them for their unwillingness to believe in him as the Messiah. The image of the shepherd and his sheep is the most used one to describe God and his people in the Bible. It appears over 500 times. It's natural that Jesus uses this image to describe leadership in Israel, both good and bad. The sheepfold that Jesus will talk about here was a common form of shelter used by shepherds for themselves and their flocks. There's a couple of kinds of sheepfolds. One sheepfold, so a sheepfold is a place that the shepherds at night would call their sheep into. If they were traveling, sometimes there would be these sheepfolds that they would come to and that they were already built. But they stacked rocks in a big circle for one type. And they'd stack those rocks up about waist high. And then on top of those rocks, they would put briars, branches, and sticks, and they'd make a very narrow gate or way into the sheepfold. The shepherd then would call his sheep into the sheepfold, feed them, bed them down, and then he would sleep in the doorway of the sheepfold. So he was that last line of defense, if you will, for the evils that were out there in the world, the wolves that would attack, the people that would come in to steal. So there was obviously a lot of work. You've got to stack up enough stones wide enough and tall enough that they'll hold. The other type of sheepfold is one where there's a cave available. So I'm got my sheep out there. I see a big old hole in the mountain. So again, I stack stones, but I don't have to stack as many stones this time, do I? Because I've already got a natural structure. excuse me. So now that we have a physical description of what Jesus is talking about, as far as the sheepfold goes, let's just start over here on this side of the room. We're going to start here in the front and just work our way zigzag through the back. If you don't want to read, just say pass. Bob, are you good to read verses 1 through 2? Would you do that for me, please?
Jesus is speaking here. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep.
Thank you. So it says here that some sheepfolds had a roughly made door, so you build something. Anybody here watched Alone? It's an entertaining show, isn't it? And these people build these shelters, and then because they want to keep wild animals out while they sleep, they will build some thing that covers that opening. So some sheepfolds had a roughly made door used to secure, cannot speak this morning, the fold once the sheep were in. It was natural for the shepherd to use this door for his comings and goings. If one were to climb over the wall, this would clearly indicate that he was an intruder, probably with the intent to steal. This was a familiar imagery to the people who counted many generations of shepherds in their families. Verse 3 through 5, Frank.
To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of the stranger.
Thank you. Jesus now extends the imagery to include one more example of false leadership. At times, several flocks would be in a sheepfold. It was common for travelers to share space, not something that we do so willingly today. But if, like James done the Boy Scouts thing, they hike up into the snow and there's some cabins or whatever you call it up there, shelters. And sometimes when these boys would go up in there, there would be other people there. And so then they would share the fire space and they would share the sleeping area. And that was, I mean, that's really the way we should be, right? With we have these travelers, we should be willing to share our space with them, not make them go someplace else. It'd be horrible for James and all his buddies to hike all the way to the top of Rosaries and find out they have to hike all the way back to the bottom to go home and sleep in their own beds. So that happened with these sheepfolds. So now, if you can imagine, we've got a bunch of sheep in a room this size, and I've got my sheep, and you've got your sheep, and sheep don't care, so they just mingle. But when it's time for me to leave and take my sheep back out to the fold, how do I get them? Well, it says here that the shepherd calls them by name, and they know the shepherd's voice. And so the shepherd would call, the sheep would go, that's the guy that feeds me, and they would follow him out. And when the shepherd left, wherever the shepherd went, the sheep would follow. The shepherd didn't follow the sheep. Like, so when we watch television, you'll see these big flocks, and you got a guy walking behind it with a stick. Here, what we're being told is that shepherd led the way, which really gives us that imagery that we're looking for, you know, and we can understand why. During COVID, about a year ago, there was all this social media nonsense about the people that would wear a mask and get a vaccine, how we were just sheep, we were followers. And I just thought it was funny that that was a term that people were wanting to use when we as Christians truly are sheep, aren't we? And we have a shepherd, and we're led by that shepherd, and we know that when we go our own way, if a sheep was to stray, the odds of it being killed or lost or stolen increase dramatically, don't they? We also can understand from this imagery that the sheep without the shepherd really would just scatter, wouldn't they? Jesus continues this parable by saying that the other sheep in the fold will not leave. So the my sheep will leave, your sheep will stay. Verse 6. You want to read that, James?
Jesus used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them.
So Jesus is using these parables, speaking to a spiritual mind, correct? And the fact that they didn't understand them. Now we have cheats, right? So when we read our Bible, it's a lot easier for us to figure this stuff out. Because we just read a little bit further, and then he tells us what he's talking about. But we most likely would be just as lost in this conversation when we're asking this question and he's giving this example. Now, hopefully they can marry that example with the question that they asked, but apparently not right now. It says, John makes another editorial comment explaining that the people did not understand the parable. Of course, they understood about sheep, that they were in the sheepfolds, that they could pick out their master's voice, even when their other voices were calling at the same time. What they did not understand is what all of this meant for them is that Jesus was explaining in these parables. So let's look at the explanation of the parable. Since they cannot open the meaning of the parable, Jesus clarifies his meanings in verses 7 through 10 and then following. So do you want to read for me, dear? Thank you. Yes, please.
So Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All those who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep do not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I come so that they will have life and have it abundantly."
Thank you. So this is another one of those Jesus' I am statements. And, you know, if you're just kind of reading through it, you might miss it. But the I am the door, I am the door. Jesus' statement here, he's declaring his divinity in this parable. And we'll see here shortly that the people are starting to get it. So the sheep come through him. Or the sheep that, excuse me, goodness sakes, let me find myself. So Jesus tells them that as the door, the sheep, coming through him will find food and nourishment when they go out, and protection and comfort when they come in. Just like the shepherd was a human door that kept intruders out and preserved the lives of the sheep within, Jesus protected against false teachers and leaders and providing saving grace for the sheep. The abundant life he gives in context is that he is the ultimate shepherd, protecting and giving eternal life to his flock. Verse 11 through 13.
When he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep.
Thank you. Here Jesus makes another I am statement, this time calling himself the good shepherd. In the Old Testament times, the only good shepherd was God. I did not have time to go back and write in my notes a good reference for that, but I will bring that to you soon. In essence, he says that just like a good shepherd would risk his life to save his sheep, Jesus would not only risk his life, he would lay down his life willingly for his flock. So it's a foretelling. In contrast to this, there is the hireling. So this is not an assistant of the shepherd or a contract worker. In this case, a hireling is someone who has gained control of the sheep in a negative way. So Nolan works for me, and when I leave my shop, I trust Nolan to represent my shop, to represent my customers, and to keep an eye on my other employees. So he's contracted with me. But as he's contracted with me to do that, we also know that we've learned that Nolan has good character. He's trustworthy. And he takes pride in whatever it is that he's doing. So in working for me, he takes pride in that, and he will do what's best for my company in my absence. This person here that Jesus is talking about, this is a person that's taken over the sheepfold. So who could he be referencing here? Satan? Yep. Closer to them right now. Pharisees. So these are these people, the scribes and the Pharisees, that have really taken over the fold for the past 400 years. They've created their own laws and their own purposes to pad their own pockets so that they could have power and prestige. And what Jesus is saying here, what he's hinting to, is that when things get bad, you're just going to abandon the flock. You're not going to lay down your life for these individuals. You are not the way to salvation for the flock. He is. Verse 14 through 18.
I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me. Even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep which are not in this fold. I must bring them also, and they will hear my voice. And they will become one flock with one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father.
All right, there's a lot said there. So the Lord, first of all, now is making his third I am statement. So when we read I am, I guess I'm assuming everybody knows that. When we read the words I am, what are we reading? What's he saying? He's God. And these people understand that. So he's taught them in parables. He's told them stories. He's done miracles. And they're still going, who are you? What are you? Why are you here? And so here he is just coming right out and saying it. I am. I am. I am. This time he speaks in the first person, so he's talking about himself. And as the good shepherd declares the following. So the first thing he declares in that set of verses is, in the way a shepherd knows his sheep and they know him, he knows who his true disciples are and they know exactly who he is. He knows the Father and the Father knows him. Secondly, he will lay down his life for his followers. He has the authority to both lay it down and then pick it back up again. What is that saying? Go ahead, Bob.
He'll raise himself from the dead.
He'll raise, okay. That's important right there. Because we've already, or we're going to see, Jesus raise people from the dead. That's the power of God through Jesus raising this person from the dead. Jesus is saying here that I not only will lay down my life, I will raise it back up again. So Jesus is going to defeat death on his own as God. This is what the Father has told him to do. This is an illusion of his resurrection. I think that it's important, you know, and I think he's making a statement here when he says, for this reason, the Father loves me because I lay down my life and that I may take it up again. And then he goes on to say that no one is taking his life. So they're planning his death, right? They were going to stone him last chapter. They're thinking about stoning him again this chapter, as we will read. They're ultimately going to crucify him. But what Jesus is saying right here is, it's me who lays down my life. The underlying part of that conversation is, I am God. I have the power. You do not have the power to kill me unless I lay my life down. So there's some authority being laid out for these individuals here. He will bring together another group of disciples. Who's he talking about?
Gentiles.
The Gentiles. Yes. All right. Verse 19 through 21. And you can pass. You got your hands full. Linda, you want to read that one for me? We'll let him read that one for you. Okay, Bob.
Okay. A division occurred again among the Jews because of these words. Many of them were saying, he has a demon and is insane. Why do you listen to him? Others were saying, these are not the sayings of one demon possessed. A demon cannot open the eyes of the blind. Can he?
Thank you. So again, John describes the reaction of the people to this latest declaration of divinity. Note that the cycle of declaration followed by belief or disbelief continues. So each time we have one of these discourses, we have people who believe and we have people who don't believe. And sometimes we have people who believe and then they listen a little bit longer and then they throw their hands up and they don't believe. So the next part of this, so 22 through 42, Jesus is going to declare his divinity without a parable. So he spoke to them in parables. They didn't get the parable. He had to explain the parable. So now he's going to go on and he's going to make it clearer. My notes here say that the Feast of Booths was in the fall, and later in December, the Jews celebrated the Feast of Dedication. This was a commemoration of the rededication of the temple after it had been desecrated by Antiochus. I can't say his name. Antiochus was a northern king who sacrificed a pig on the altar of the temple during an invasion of the holy city several hundred years before. They also called it the Feast of Lights because all of the houses were lit up during the celebration. Today, the Jews still celebrate the feast, and it's called Hanukkah. Lighting of candles is the principle of the ceremony. Verses 22 through 24. Can someone read those for me? Is that you, Linda? All right, okay.
At that time, the Feast of the Dedication took place in Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple
and portico of Solomon. The Jews then gathered around him and were saying to him, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly."
Thank you. So it's now been a few months since his clash with the Pharisees, and Jesus finds himself once again in the temple area during his feast. This time the Pharisees urge him to make a clear declaration about his identity. No parables. Of course, their objective is to have a solid charge to make against him. They are not asking this question because of faith. So what do they want? They want him to come right out and say the words, "I am God." So then what can they accuse him of?
Blasphemy.
Blasphemy. And what does blasphemy carry as a punishment?
Death.
So, verses 25 through 31. It's a race to see which one of you get there first.
Jesus, I told you, and you did not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, these testify of me. But you did not believe, because you are not of my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give eternal life to them, and they will never perish. And no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one.
All right. I have a little footnote at the end of that. It says the Jews picked up stones again to stone him. So pretty blunt, right? We've talked in parables. We've told stories. Now he just comes right out and tells them. Now, these Pharisees were men of power, weren't they? Great power. Great prominence. That's part of the problem. Sometimes when we get power, we don't want to give up power. We become the boss, and we don't want to be bossed. We become the second in command, and we want to be the first in command. And so we beat down all the little people below us, and we puff up our chests, and we have all this great power. And then when our boss comes in to set things straight, we struggle with that. Or a new manager comes in, and we struggle with that. I hire another employee, and that employee's got more experience, and we struggle with that. The Pharisees have had this power. And they have had the blessings of this power for quite some time. They don't want to lose that power. But right now, so we're on Solomon's porch, and Larry's showed us pictures, and we've looked at it. It is huge. And it's where people would gather, and there would be speaking out there outside the temple. And we'll read about it more later on. But it was a big area, and there's a lot of people there, and I doubt very seriously that it's just the Pharisees that are standing and listening. And Jesus says, "I told you, and you do not believe." So who are you? I already told you that. I've told you multiple times. But he goes on in these verses to just spell it out. I and the Father are one. So Jesus responded with clarity, but a clarity they are not ready to accept. So he's just told them, they asked, "Who are you?" "I'm the Christ." They're not ready to accept that, are they? In answer to the question, he says three things. True believers accept the proof that he has provided in the miracles the Father has given him to do. They are not true believers, because they rejected him and the proof that he offers. He knows and is known by his true followers, and they have demonstrated that they are not true by what they've done in the past. The question implies that he should do more to convince them. He claims that he's done enough to convince them. Have we heard that before? Maybe by somebody that wasn't a Pharisee? Show us, show me, Father, show me who you are. Show us a sign that we'll know. Who said that to Jesus? Thomas. His own apostles said, show us and we'll believe. And what was his response? I already showed you. I already showed you.
That can be kind of comforting for us, because God, or Jesus, reminded the apostles numerous times. They didn't always get a hold of it the first time around.
Yeah.
And so we're human just like the apostles were.
Yeah, so they walked side by side with Jesus, and they saw what he did, and they heard what he said, and they witnessed all of those acts, and they still had questions, didn't they? Have you ever had questions?
I have.
Yeah. How do you feel when you have questions? I always do this. We get sidetracked.
Ignorant.
Yeah. Well, I feel ashamed. I mean, don't you? You feel ashamed when you have doubt, when you have questions. Because we're all silly enough to think that we're the only ones that have that doubt or that question. So we feel like we're all alone in our doubt, and we look around the room, you know. So let's say we bring in some young people, and they look around the room and they're like, oh man, you know, look at, no one's back here running. He's running the show. Look at that. Of course, no one's getting old. He's got a baby on the way. He's got to show some responsibilities. But we look at these other young men here and we see, oh, he's a song leader and he leads prayers, and I could never do that. How do they have that at this young age? How do they have that faith? Maybe I'm a 30-year-old and I'm coming here for the first time and I'm looking up here at all these young people doing things and I think, wow, I have wasted so much time. And sometimes we will get to a point to where we're like, I'll never get there. Or the preacher will stand up here and preach to you about heaven and the blessings of heaven and the fact that we can have a peace which passes all understanding, which I don't understand. And we think, oh, I'll just never get it. So Bob's point is an excellent point in the fact that these apostles didn't always get it. Our children don't always get what we're trying to teach them until they have children of their own and they're like, ha ha, Mom was right. You know, it's just a natural part of life. Now, the difference is these Pharisees have set themselves up as a wall against Jesus. So they are fighting Jesus, which, as Jesus says, as you're fighting me, you are fighting God. And in that case, we don't necessarily sugarcoat those conversations, do we? Jesus knows he's not going to change their minds. So Jesus says that he and the Father are one. He is equal to, the same as, united to, and shares the nature of God. Of course, for the Jews who do not believe, this is what? It's blasphemy, punishable by death. Verse 32 says, I'll go ahead and read that one because it's short and it's big enough print. Jesus answers them, I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them will you stone me? So they're standing there right now with rocks in their hands. And in times past, Jesus has gone out among them. We're not really sure how that works, but he just isn't there anymore for them to stone him. But he stands right here and he says, all right, I stepped on your toes. I was aiming for your heart. But what is it that I did? What is it that I said that you're going to stone me for? You're going to stone me because I made a blind man see? Jesus points out the inconsistency of their actions. They have proof. They've asked for proof. They have proof of his divinity, but they're acting against it anyway. Verse 33, Eileen.
Jesus answered him, for a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy. And because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God.
Thank you. So, In effect, Jesus makes them declare clearly their disbelief in him. Their stumbling block is that they cannot accept that God could be in the form of man. So this was too much for them to consider. I'm not really sure what they were looking for. They were looking for a Messiah, weren't they? They were looking for someone to overthrow the Romans, to give them back power so that they could be the greatest nation. But I'm not really sure how they pictured that, in what form. Can somebody read verses 34 through 38? Thank you. So Jesus says that it is not such a stretch to assign the title of divinity to humans. Even in the Old Testament, there were such references for those who served God as prophets. It's over in Psalms 8:17. See if I can find that. Or somebody else finds it before me. Well, it says here in my notes, Psalms 8:17, but I'm in Psalms 8, and it stops at 9. So, not really sure what point our author was trying to make there, but we're going to skip it for right now, and I will look that one up for you. If those who were sent by God as prophets were called gods in the Scripture, surely one who does the miracle of God and speaks for God can be called the Son of God. If you do not believe my teachings here, at least acknowledge the miracles. These do not lie. Verse 39, therefore they were seeking again to seize him, and he eluded their grasp. So once again the Jews, quite unconvinced, tried to arrest. Once again, because this time, Because this time was not at hand, his time was not at hand, he managed to elude their attempts to capture him. Can somebody read the last two verses, 40 through 42? That's three verses.
And he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was first baptized, and he stayed there. Many came to him and were saying, while John performed no sign, yet everything John said about this man was true.
All right. So John summarizes the scene and the section by closing the cycle in this same familiar way. Jesus goes out of Jerusalem to continue preaching and baptizing. The people's rationale for following him was, we believe John. So these people had seen John out baptizing. So we believe John, even without miracles. So isn't that crazy? All these people believe what John the Baptist is saying, and he's not doing any miracles. He's just this man in the desert, wild man in the desert. And yet they believe what he has to say. And so now they're going to put two and two together. This man does miracles and fulfills all the things that John said about him. Because of this, some believed. And despite all this, some still disbelieved. So, what can we take away from that? This last statement here. So, because of this, some believed. And despite all of this, some still didn't believe. So, we've been given, through the last three chapters, all of this proof, these miracles, these teachings, that Jesus is the Christ. And some believe so clearly, and some disbelieve. What can we take away from that?
It's going to be the same way today. We're all free agents, so to speak. We have a mind of our own to make up, to either accept or reject.
Exactly. So let's just think about baptism. If you just think about the subject of baptism, we can, in very short order, go to verse after verse after verse in the Bible to define and explain, A, the need for baptism, B, the means of baptism. Can't we? And we feel like we could all do that fairly comfortably. Maybe not right off the cuff, but we could open up our Bibles and we could find those verses. And yet we will sit down with someone from a different belief system, denomination, if you will, and have that conversation, and they simply cannot see it. So does that mean that I'm just a poor teacher? That could be yes. Sometimes people simply aren't going to believe the truth, no matter how you lay the truth out. So that's an out for us, right? We simply just don't have to bother. Well, if they go to that church down there, we don't need to talk to them because they're not going to believe. What's our job as Christians?
Be patient.
Yeah.
Teach them.
We're just to teach them. Now, Jesus is teaching, and he's teaching not only to the Pharisees, but he's also teaching for us. And yet, not everybody's going to believe. But we can have this large group that doesn't believe, and out of that large group, we can get a handful of people that do believe. They can put two and two together. So our job is to simply be that vessel to teach. And when people don't believe, it's tempting for us to just throw our hands in the air and quit and say, well, I'm just not any good at this. But what should we be doing? Continuing on.
Setting an example.
Yeah. You know what? A horrible teacher is way better than no teacher. We can stammer and stutter and be a horrible reader, whatever you want to call it, but we have this calling, don't we? To study and to teach and to believe. So keep that in mind. I will go ahead and dismiss this for 9 minutes.